Before he issued his executive order on immigration, Donald Trump's biggest political problems may have involved his views about Vladimir Putin and allegations of Russian hacking during the election. Come to think of it, Russia may be getting more attention now than at any time since the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. But how well do we understand Russia or the Russian people beyond the news headlines? Lisa Dickey traveled the breadth of seven Russian time zones from Vladivostok to St. Petersburg three times in 1995, 2005, and 2015, and she describes her travels and the people she met in her new book from St. Martin's Press, Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. I'm very pleased it has brought Lisa Dickey to our show now. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
What route did you take? Did you skip the northeast extremes like the coast on the Bering Strait?
Yes, we did not. I did not go very far north at all. We just took the route essentially of the Trans-Siberian from Vladivostok to St. Petersburg.
And the first trip was in 1995. Why were you interested in undertaking such a trip then?
So I, at the time, was actually living in Russia and working as a freelance journalist. And I saw an email from this American photographer who was based in Paris who said, I want to go across Russia and do this black and white photo essay. It'll take about 3 months. I don't really speak Russian. I need somebody who can basically just take off and go to the hinterlands with me. And I thought that sounded, excuse me, like the greatest thing I'd ever heard in my life.
Did he want you to write about it as well?
He was open to that. Well, so this is the interesting bit of it, right? So it wasn't just a black and white photo essay. In 1995, he had this prototype digital camera, which was something that I had never seen before. And his idea was to do a real-time web travelogue across Russia, which I just thought he was insane. I thought, how in the world will you ever be able to upload photographs from Siberia? That just sounded nuts to me. But we were able to do it. We had an arrangement with Sprint, and we, you know, connected to their telecom nodes and were able to do that. So.
And you were living in St. Petersburg, not Moscow.
Correct.
Yes. In 1994 or 1995, were people still saying Leningrad as opposed to St. Petersburg?
No, it was St. Petersburg by then. After the Soviet Union fell, they went back to St. Petersburg. And so I had just literally rented an apartment there for $100 a month and was trying to, you know, make my way as a writer.
What were things like in those early years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union at the end of December 1991?
It was a tremendously chaotic time in Russia. The ruble had collapsed. People had lost their life savings. Boris Yeltsin was the president. They were 4 years out of the Soviet Union when I did this first trip, and there was such a high degree of nervousness that people had and fear about. They didn't know what was coming next. They didn't know, you know, what their lives would bring. And there was just definitely a lot of uncertainty.
And still angry at Gorbachev?
Yeah, there was a fair amount of anger at him. Yeah, I think people felt like, you know, why did he do this if he didn't know what was coming next, essentially? And then you had Yeltsin, who was not, shall we say, a paragon of stability. And there were a lot of reasons why Russia was unstable that weren't Yeltsin's fault. But it just felt like, I think for people, it just felt really out of control.
You quote John Steinbeck from his 1948 book, A Russian Journal. Quote, in the papers every day, there were thousands of words about Russia, and it occurred to us that there were some things that nobody wrote about Russia, and they were the things that interested us most of all. Are Americans still missing things about Russia?
I think so, tremendously so. I don't think Americans really have an idea. You know, I like to say there are 140 million plus other Russians other than Vladimir Putin, but Putin is really the only one that we talk about.
And that despite the fact that the internet and social media have taken off in the 20 years since you started doing this?
They have, but I mean, if you ask the average American how much they're interacting with Russians on social media or the internet, I mean, you know, the only answer you'll get back probably is, well, we saw, you know, in the political process, the emails get hacked, but it's not like people have any real connection with Russians, certainly in Russia.
You travel with a photographer in the second trip as well.
Yes.
Did that affect the way you approached your project?
I think, you know, traveling with another person and, you know, traveling with a photographer, I think did affect it to a certain degree because, you know, then you're sort of like, here are these two people and they're coming and they're reporting. And I have to say, like, you know, on this third trip that I did in 2015, I went and saw all the same people, and I was welcomed, I think, more as a friend than I was, okay, here's this journalist and she's back doing this again.
I'm speaking with Lisa Dickey, whose latest book is Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. It is published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How does our view of Russia or Russians compare with what you witnessed? Are some of the ideas Americans have about the country way off base?
Yeah, I think so. I think we tend to think of Russians as not tremendously friendly people and sort of rather cold. And, you know, my experience is, you know, strangers in Russia, like people walking down the street, they're not going to say hello. They're not going to be friendly. But boy, once you're in a Russian person's house, they can just be extremely warm and extremely generous. And I was treated very generously on all three of the trips.
Even when there's tensions between the countries?
Yeah. And that was, you know, that was very interesting for me because I and just to sort of clarify, you know, I went on these 11 cities and I talked to the same people over these 20 years. And so, you know, the first trip there was very much a pro-American feeling going on. People were, the Soviet Union had fallen, they were getting this influx of American culture, and a lot of people were seemed very pro-America to me. By 2015, you know, I was reading all these articles just before I took the trip that basically said anti-American sentiment is as high as it's been since the 50s and 60s. So
well,
I was
supposedly
quite nervous.
Putin was stirring people up.
Yes. So I was quite nervous about it. You know, here I come showing up again, basically, hi, here I am at your house. You know, can we talk? And people were very careful to say, we really don't like your government. We really don't like what your government is doing. They really didn't like Barack Obama. That was pretty much universal. But everyone then said, we don't have a quarrel with the American people. We're glad that you're here. We're very happy to have you.
And they didn't like Barack Obama because of the sanctions or other reasons?
There were a lot of reasons. I mean, I think as is pretty clear by now, Putin has systematically shut down a lot of the opposition journalism. And so a lot of what Russians get in their news is stuff that the Kremlin wants them to get. And there has been sort of a relentless drumbeat of anti-Obama and anti-American government stuff. And so their feeling is, who is this guy? He's such a – you can't trust anything he says, and he lies, and he's a weakling, and all kinds of stuff.
The U.S. and Russia have disagreed over Ukraine, Syria, NATO expansion. In 1995 – the United States was criticizing Russia's actions in the first Chechen war. How much of this filters through to the Russian people?
How much of?
Well, do they understand why the United States might be upset about the annexation of Crimea, for example?
So that,
and
that
the invasion,
in particular,
the constant
yeah.
invasions of Ukraine, which are maybe denied by their government, but quite obviously happening.
Yes. I mean, I think with regards to Crimea, certainly, I did talk with people a lot about this because this trip took place in the fall of 2015, and it was an extremely hot topic. And, you know, the message I kept getting from people was, Americans can't possibly understand the centuries of history that we have with Ukraine. You know, there's so many Russian ethnic people living in Crimea. There was an election. You know, their feeling was, and again, this is bolstered by the news that they get, which is, you know, which is the Kremlin's essentially arm of the news, was, you know, you guys can't possibly understand this. This is rather a normal thing, but you're getting, you know, you're getting upset over nothing.
So they were unaware of all of the protests against the pro-Russian government that led to the changes in Ukraine's government?
I don't think they were unaware of it. I think that they tend to think that those types of things are stirred up by the West specifically.
Hillary Clinton was doing it and Barack Obama.
Yeah. She also was extremely unpopular among people I talked with.
Didn't you travel to Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan,
yes.
which is hundreds of miles from Chechnya, but majority Muslim like Chechnya? Are the places with Muslim populations happy with the situation?
Well, the fascinating thing about Tatarstan and Kazan in particular was that, you know, especially in 1995 when we were there and there was all the fighting going on in Chechnya and there was a lot of animosity between the Chechens and the Russians all across Russia. You know, Chechens are, you know, not popular people in Russia. And then, you know, as you say, several hundred miles to the north, there's Tatarstan and Kazan. And there wasn't any of that kind of animosity that I could detect. And I talked to a lot of people about it. I mean, this is not to say, oh, it's some sort of Pollyanna thing, everybody's so happy. But here's an extraordinary thing about Kazan. Kazan has an ancient Kremlin there, you know, 500-year-old Kremlin, your classic Russian fortress. And inside the Kremlin walls in 2005, they rebuilt a Muslim mosque that had been torn down before. So it's this really rather extraordinary sight of this giant mosque inside Kremlin walls. And it was, I mean, it was surprising to me how little I felt of antagonism between the Tatars and the Russians there.
They tore down the mosques for the same reason that they tore down some of the Russian Orthodox churches.
Yes.
The Soviet Union, in theory anyway, was atheistic, even if that wasn't always the case and the church wasn't.
It certainly was officially
atheistic. Used as part of the political
process.
Well,
they turned Kazan Cathedral, which is a gorgeous cathedral in St. Petersburg, into the Museum of Atheism during the Soviet era. So there was that.
Several people you spoke with described Americans as imagining bears in Russian streets. Where did they get that idea?
So this is where the title comes from. The second day that I was in Vladivostok, I had a woman say, well, you know, Americans all think we just have bears wandering in the streets. And I said, oh, you know, that's funny. I don't think we really think that, but, you know, I'll take that. And, you know, I'll take that and file it away. And then literally five or six more times in five or six different cities, I had a Russian person say exactly the same thing to me.
So somebody must be writing about that in Russia.
I think it must be that. I never did figure out exactly what it was. But what I came up with was, I think, you know, Russians feel like, if you think about it, during the Soviet era, there were two superpowers in the world. There was the United States and the Soviet Union. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, and suddenly Russia's economy fell to pieces. It was considered a weak country, and nobody really cared what Russia had to say about anything. Then you get Vladimir Putin into office in 2000, and he, for lack of a better term, is, you know, aims at making Russia great again. And so I think this whole bears in the streets thing seemed to me that it was mostly people saying, you still think we're like backwards. You still think we're not all that. But, you know, you're going to see we're stronger than you think we are.
I wonder if any of the reports about Betsy DeVos saying that grizzlies might go into American public schools have reached the
Russians. I actually don't know the answer to that, but she does seem a little obsessed with bears.
What views about Americans did you find Russians expressing most often? I mean, we were talking about American misconceptions about Russians.
Right.
What are their misconceptions about us?
I think that they have a lot of the same the same feelings about Americans that a lot of non-Americans have, which is that we kind of stomp around all over the world, you know, trying to make our agenda happen. And we think our way or the highway and that kind of thing.
The ugly Americans.
Yeah, basically.
And I think of Russians often as the ugly Russians.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
we cancel each other out.
Yeah. I gave a talk to a class of journalism students at Georgetown, and I asked them, you know, what do you think about Russian people? Do you think there are bears in the streets? And they said, no, but, you know, what do you think of? Well, we think of vodka, and we think of, you know, strong accents and really cold, and they sound like Count Dracula, you know? So.
Did you have at least one tense conversation with a couple of women in
Chelyabinsk.
Chelyabinsk. That's a city only a little smaller than Dallas, north of Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of this city before. Dallas is pretty big.
Yes. Well, you know, Chelyabinsk was not a city that many people had heard of until they rather famously in 2013 had a meteor that shot across the sky. Remember that? Yeah, that was Chelyabinsk. So they gained a little bit of fame for that. But yes, I had a very difficult conversation with a couple of sisters that I had met them in 1995. They were 11 and 16, and I interviewed them then. And, you know, every 10 years I talked to them, so 21 and 26, and now they're 31 and 36. And the older sister was very, very anti-American government and very much felt like I was naive about my own government and my own country. And her take was, look, the Russian press is more free than the American press is. Russian people are more free than American people are. And the fact that I didn't see that was just really vexing to her.
And I'm sure you felt the same way on the other side.
Yes, I felt vexed in return. Yes, exactly.
But were there things that people didn't want to talk about? There are dissidents in Russia.
Yes, and you know, it's
including one who just being sent to jail for obviously untrumped up charges.
And I think it's very important to clarify that, you know, 11 cities I went to, you know, most of them were far from Moscow and St. Petersburg. And in the same way that, you know, you have things that happen in New York and Washington, you know, New York and Washington are not representative of the United States of America in the same way Moscow and St. Petersburg are not. So, you know, if people travel to Moscow and St. Petersburg and they meet people there, they're probably meeting people who are a little more sophisticated about what it is that's going on in the rest of the world. And so, you know, it's a different thing.
Well, you mentioned that the press is controlled, but there's still the internet. And as far as I can tell, there's an awful lot of sophisticated knowledge about how to use the internet, at least in some circles.
There absolutely is.
Does that mean that you know what you want to know?
Well, I think, look, I traveled across the whole country, and it's not like North Korea or China where all these sites are blocked. Like, you can't, if you're in North Korea, you can't read the New York Times online. If you're in Russia, you can. But of course, it's written in English. And, they don't trust that that's, straight up news either. Everything is, they feel like we publish news that's good for America, and they publish, I feel like they publish news that's good for Russia. So
wasn't that the feeling when Voice of America was popular in Russia? Have things changed now that there aren't as many people in Russia listening to jazz?
I don't know. It's been interesting to see the arc that that this has taken, where, you couldn't get freely exchange, American television and movies and music and all that in the Soviet era. And then you could in the 90s. And there was just this explosion of interest and appreciation, I think, for American culture. And then it's just slowly but surely, there's a serious wave of Russian nationalism, of people saying, like, let's buy stuff that's made in Russia. There's a bumper sticker where there's a bear filing his claws with a big nail file, and across it is written sanctions. And this is how they feel about, the fact that we've imposed sanctions and the fact that we are trying to harm or injure them in some way. They're like, you have no idea. This is going to come back and bite you.
My guest is Lisa Dickey, who has written or ghostwritten 17 published nonfiction books, including a number of bestsellers. Her latest book is Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia, published by St. Martin's Press. And we will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Lisa Dickey. Her book, Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across Changing Russia, published by St. Martin's Press. Was it easy to travel across Russia back in 1995?
It was relatively easy. The photographer Gary Matoso, who I went with, he and I had business visas, and we just, bought each leg of the rail as we went. We did have a little bit of trouble in one town where they thought, here's some Americans who haven't registered properly, and what are they doing here? And that was a little nerve-wracking. But generally speaking, all of the three trips have been relatively easy.
What about the legacy of Soviet attitudes in 1995? Did they linger?
There was some of that, yeah. In fact, our first stop in Vladivostok, we went to the lighthouse that's really just at the very edge of Vladivostok to go try to meet the couple who took care of it. And they were very nervous about our being there. It was technically a military installation, and until very recently, Vladivostok had been a closed city, and so there were no foreigners at all. And so our presence did make them a little bit nervous. They still welcomed us. And then later, on the next two trips, 2005 and 2015, they had no trouble at all. So
Russia is huge. How easy was it, to travel? Is it like they don't have high-speed trains the way Japan does and China is developing?
They have some high-speed trains now between Moscow and St. Petersburg. But if you're taking the Trans-Siberian, you're kind of meandering along through the country.
When Vice President Biden described LaGuardia Airport as third world, would he just as easily have been describing what's going on in Russia?
I don't think so at all, because I think just the Trans-Siberian Railway itself, the 5,700 miles of it, is just an extraordinary achievement. And the trains run on time and they're quite comfortable. So
and they're kept up. Obviously, it was built a long time ago.
Yeah. But it's funny, like it hadn't really changed that much between 1995 and 2015. There were some minor upgrades that they had. But it really is very much the same as it's been for years.
There was a joke during the Cold War that if you were in a Russian hotel room and it lacked the basics like towels, if you complained loudly, listening devices would pick that up and someone would appear at the door with them. Do you feel like people are listening now?
I mean, I didn't feel like people were, but, maybe I'm naive. I don't know. I stayed in some hotels. I stayed in some people's homes. I was concerned about that before I took this 2015 trip. But then I don't know. I just didn't find that I was having any issues with that.
You had been to the Soviet Union before the dissolution.
Yes, I had spent 7 months in Moscow in the late 1980s, yeah.
Does the fact that your first and last names sound like Russian words help you when you're meeting Russian people?
Well, it's very helpful to have a name like Lisa because it is very easily Russianized to Lisa. But what you're referring to is kind of the funny thing. There's Lisa with the emphasis on the A actually means fox. And my last name, Dicky, if you say it in Russian, Diki or Dikaya, it would be wild. So
you're a wild fox in some people's minds?
I'm the wild fox.
You're openly gay. Did that have any impact? Because we've heard about homophobia in Russia.
This was another issue I was obviously very nervous about. I was reluctant to be completely closeted or to lie about my situation. I'm married and have been married for, at that point, 6 years. And I just made a decision that I would tell people on this trip. And I did. I told most of the people that I spoke with. A couple things I'll say about that. Well, first of all, the response I got most often from people was, I'm okay with it, but don't tell anybody else. I heard that repeatedly. I can't say that I had a lot of problems. I will also say these people all had, known me since 20 years ago. And also I'm a woman and I think that makes it easier.
Because there've been reports of gangs luring gay men into meetings and then beating them up.
Yes. I mean, you have to be.
And then Putin has said some things that might be interpreted as homophobic.
Look, it's clearly a homophobic society in the sense that they have a law now that it's illegal to propagandize sexual minority behavior to children. Now, that can be interpreted in any way the police or the government would like to interpret it, and it has a very chilling effect. On the other hand, I do think, Russia seems to me anyway, a society where people will mind their own business. If they, it's really more my experience and the gay people that I spoke with there, it seemed to me sort of don't ask, don't tell writ large. As long as you don't go around talking a lot about it, everybody's cool. This is what they all said to me.
What about the fact that Russia and in its western side is European and its eastern side is Asian? And there also, I remember years ago, somebody telling me, once you cross the Danube, you should assume that everybody's an anti-Semite.
I mean, anti-Semitism is obviously a huge problem. And just to go back to the gay thing, too, I don't mean to sound like Pollyanna, like, oh, I had no problem and it's no problem. It's clearly a huge problem, but I just wanted to sort of clarify that.
But are there tensions between the East and Western Russians?
I mean, I think, that was not my experience so much. I would think that the tension, lies between ethnic minorities and ethnic Russians, right, in general. So, yes, if you're Jewish in Russia, you're going to face some anti-Semitism. If you are Buryat or if you are, a different ethnic minority, you're probably, especially Chechen or some of these, other people who are from the Caucasus region, you're going to experience some kind of racist behavior.
Despite the official atheism, didn't the Soviets establish autonomy of a kind for some regions? You visited the autonomous oblast, the Jewish region.
The Jewish autonomous region, yes. So this was set up by Joseph Stalin in the late 20s and early 1930s. And it was essentially, a way to say, okay, hey, all you Jewish families, here's free train ticket and free meals to get you out to this area. We're going to create for you this wonderful homeland.
So get out of Moscow?
Basically, yeah. And it's 5,000 miles away. If you look on a map of Russia and you find Birbijan, you will think, oh my gosh, that is really in the middle of nowhere. And it is. And that was the whole purpose of sending them there. So they're like, okay, go here. And they, had these beautiful brochures and posters of all these, happy looking people. And the reality was quite different. It's very far. It's very harsh climate. And then, in the 40s and 50s, then they started shutting down the synagogues and shutting down the freedom of worship and the freedom of, of studying, Yiddish and whatever else it was that they were studying. And that went on forever until, the Jewish community shrank. And as soon as they were able in the 1980s, people started flooding out. And so by the time Gary and I got there in 1995, there were just a very, very small number of Jewish people remaining and no functioning synagogue.
And who
no
lives
rabbi.
There now?
Well, so the funny thing is I thought after that 1995 trip, oh, okay, that's it. When I come back in 2005, there won't be any Jewish people left. But in fact, there were more people in 2005, partly because a lot of people who had been afraid to reveal their Jewish identity in the 90s now were more able to do so. And the Russian government and some other organizations, Jewish organizations internationally, had put some money into Birbijan and opened a synagogue and brought a rabbi in from Israel.
But Stalin moved people all around, not just on religious grounds. There are German-speaking areas that are far from Germany. He did this kind of to control people?
I mean, it's a little bit out of my pay grade to, you know, speculate on why Stalin did the things that he did. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's safe to say that whatever Stalin did, he did in order to maintain control.
You traveled to major cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Novosibirsk. How does urban life there compare with life in large cities in this country like New York or Los Angeles? Where
very similar. I would say very similar. Yeah.
Met a rap musician in Moscow?
Yes, yeah.
Does rapping work with the Russian language?
Yeah, it does. There's really, if you Google some Russian rap, you'll see it's really, there's some really interesting and great stuff. But when I first met this rapper in 1995, he was kind of the only one, and people weren't sure what to make of him. MC Pavlov.
Now it's popular?
Yes, it's very popular now. Yeah.
Although he didn't win a Grammy. Isn't much of Russia very sparsely populated? How representative can major cities like Moscow or St. Petersburg be?
There are vast swaths of Russia that are not populated at all. Obviously in the north because it's permafrost, but then, you know, also across the south. I mean, it's just unfathomable how huge this country is. You've got this handful of big cities and then a lot of much, much smaller places.
And I assume that when you went to some of the smaller places, you may have been the first American people ever met. But here in the United States, urbanization has brought growing tensions between cities and rural areas, tensions that emerged in the presidential election, for example. Are there similar issues in Russia?
I think as in many countries, you know, there's people who move from the more rural areas and smaller towns into the big cities, and they, you know, in some cases are growing more quickly than, you know, than people can handle. I mean, the traffic problem in Moscow is just tremendously huge, and it's just, there's a lot of problems with that kind of growth.
Every time I see a play by Chekhov, I'm reminded that feudalism lasted longer in Russia than any other country, any European country anyway. Do we still see the legacy of it in some areas?
I mean, I think, you know, to understand Russia, Russian people today and Russia today in 2015, you have to not only understand the past 25 years of post-Soviet Russia, which I've tried to do with this book, but also to really truly understand that 70 years that they spent, you know, as a communist society or as a, you know, a socialist economy. And then previous to that, as you say, you know, this feudalism, it's a really just a far, far different kind of history than anything we are familiar with.
People were predicting a smooth transition from communism into capitalism. It turns out to have been a rather shocking one.
Yeah, not smooth at all. It was truly not smooth at all. I mean, people were really in shock, you know, in 1995 when I did that trip. I mean, it was difficult to interview so many people who'd lost their life savings when the ruble collapsed. And they just really, there was just a great deal of uncertainty and fear.
How do opinions vary from one part of the country to another? Do you see a degree of variation of the sort that you might see in New York City versus West Virginia?
Sure, absolutely, yeah. I mean, like I say, you know, you take St. Petersburg and Moscow, it's kind of like you're New York and Washington, you know, and it's just a different, you're just going to get different kinds of conversations and different things that people are focused on.
The last time you were there was 2015, so Donald Trump's name probably didn't come up very often.
You know, I didn't really ask anybody.
Are you
anybody.
In touch with any of the people you
I'm actually
you saw?
Facebook friends with a lot of the people that I you know, talked to on the trip. I have not spent a lot of time asking them about the whole Donald Trump thing. But I'm, as I understand it, I mean, I think most of Russia was quite pleased. I will say that I did ask a lot of people about Hillary Clinton, and almost universally she was immensely disliked. And so I can only assume that all of those people are quite happy that she is not the president.
What about the generation gap? Russians in their 20s or younger can't remember much of anything of what life was like during the Soviet years. How does that affect their outlook?
It's a big difference. It was really fascinating on this trip for me to talk to, you know, people in their late teens and in their early 20s who hadn't even been born when the Soviet Union collapsed, and to find that, you know, in general, there is a trend where young people are focusing on their health a lot more than the older generations had done. They are not smoking as much. They're not drinking as much. And again, this is anecdotal. It's very difficult to come by real data. But I talked to a lot of people, you know, who said, you know, most of my friends don't smoke. They don't drink. I can't tell you how many times I had conversations with young Russians where they said, oh, I try to make sure everything's organic and GMO-free and everything that I eat. And this just came as such a surprise to me because I just wasn't used to hearing that.
So all of the talk about getting past the alcoholism that plagued Russia has had an effect, or is it just that younger people?
I think that I'm not sure it's so much that. I think a couple things. I think that, you know, sometimes things like this are cyclical, but also if you think about it, you know, Vladimir Putin is rather famously a teetotaler. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He's a black belt in karate. He's all about discipline, really. He kind of radiates discipline in that way.
And according to Saturday Night Live, he never wears a shirt.
Yeah, that's right. And he never wears a shirt. That's right. So, yeah. So I think, you know, to a certain extent, maybe these young people are just seeing this as an example and just thinking like, okay, like, let's give that a try.
You have gone to Russia every 10 years. Do you have plans to go in 2025?
Absolutely. I want to go back and see how everybody's doing again. Uh-huh. I'm a little addicted to this whole 10 years later thing now.
And do they, when they see you, do they greet you with open arms?
They do. Yeah, they do. It's great. I mean, there was one woman on the trip who did not particularly want to talk. I totally understood why. She told me she was out of town. I called her on her cell phone. She said she was out of town. I suspect she really didn't want to talk. But I got it, because the story about her was about her son who had been killed in Chechnya. And it was a really tragic and awful story. And I can only imagine that, you know, 20 years after I had first interviewed her, she probably thought, you know, I think I've talked about this enough.
Lisa Dickey, her latest book, Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Lisa, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.